incident with a smoke bomb were just some of the reasons he rattled off as my mother sat silently on the couch with the phone to her ear. Her conviction was increasing with every bad report. Meanwhile, upstairs, Shine and I sat in my room watching television. Or trying to. Our 18-inch color television, topped with a wire hanger where the antenna should have been, was a blizzard of snow. I got bored and looked around for alternative entertainment. The only thing available was my sister. I began to lightly punch her in the arm, first with my right fist, then with my left, trying to get her to pay attention to me. She stubbornly kept staring at the ghostly images of Pat Sajak and Vanna White flickering through breaks in the snow. Eventually, she told me to stop, never taking her eyes off the screen, but I kept on aiming blows at her shoulder. Boredom in teenage boys is a powerful motivation to create chaos. At that moment, Shani's arm was my time filler. Finally fed up, Shani turned to tell me to stop, and as she did, my right knuckle skipped off her shoulder and into her bottom lip, which immediately stained red. In more shock than pain, Shani saw this as an opportunity. "Ooh, I'ma get you now," she said. She smiled slyly as the blood covered her bottom row of teeth. The smile faded, and her bottom lip began to tremble. Her eyes filled with tears, and then came the scream.
"Mommy! Wesley hit me in the face and I'm bleeding really bad!"
Damn. I tried to stop her from running to my mother, but she beat me to the door and began a full sprint down the hallway. Her screaming continued as she disappeared down the stairs. Her acting was stellar. And since she still had the blood on her rapidly swelling lip and the crocodile tears streaming down her face, I knew the evidence was against me. There was nothing left to do but wait. I sat back in front of the television and watched as Vanna came briefly into view, strutting across the stage to turn a blank tile into the letter R. When I heard my mother coming up the stairs, I braced myself. She walked into my room, tired from her long day at work, disappointed by the conversation she had just had with my dean, and furious after seeing her youngest with a split lip that her only son had given her. As soon as she came close enough, I tried to plead my case, but as it turned out, she had nothing to say. She simply pulled her right hand back and slapped me. The burn consumed the entire left side of my face. Not willing to show fear or weakness, I stood there looking back at her. I guess she was expecting tears or apologies. When neither came, she reached back and unloaded another slap to my face. She looked at me again, waiting for a reaction. My jaws clenched and my hands balled into fists. By this time, I was 5 inches taller than she was, and my recently defined shoulders, biceps, and triceps made me look older than my age. Every reflex inside said to strike back, but I didn't. How could I? She was my everything, the person I loved and respected most in the world. I had no idea what to do. Neither did my mother, it seemed. Her almond-shaped eyes were overflowing with anger, disappointment, and confusion, and maybe even a little fear. I would never have hit my mother, but in my room, at that moment, she was not so sure. She looked at me as if for the first time. The days when she could physically intimidate me were clearly over. She turned around and walked out of the room. She was devastated. She was losing her son, and she was not sure how to turn the tide. We didn't know it at the time, but once alone, we both started to cry. After my first sergeant left the room, I lay back down and pulled the covers back over myself. As my head hit the pillow, I smirked to think that I could make them leave my room so easily. I was from the Bronx, after all. Maybe these country jokers were intimidated. Maybe I could manage this military school thing. Moments later, the door slammed open again, hitting the wall so hard flakes of the crusty blue paint chipped off. My entire chain of command, 8 large and angry teenagers, entered the room and without saying a word, picked my mattress up off the top bunk and turned it over, dropping me 5 feet to the cold, hard, green-tiled floor. Welcome to military school. Valley Forge Military Academy is in Wayne, Pennsylvania. It's on the prestigious main line, just 25 minutes outside Philadelphia, on a rolling campus surrounded by overgrown foliage. It was a more austere version of Riverdale, a far cry from my Bronx neighborhood. Our days began before the sun came up and ended well after it retired. Over our first few days, we would learn how to shine our shoes using Kiwi black shoe polish, a cotton rag, and a pretty disgusting amount of saliva. We would learn how to execute military commands and repeat our drill and ceremony so many times that right face, left face, and parade rest became as familiar as our own names. We would learn how to square our meals, a way of eating that forced us to slow down and savor the sometimes unidentifiable cuisine we were forced to eat, and square the corridors, which required marching around the entire hallway to leave the building, even if the exit was only a few steps away from your room. Our birth names were irrelevant, as were our past acquaintances and past accomplishments and past failures. We were the same now. We were nothing. In fact, we were less than nothing. We were plebes. My squad leader, Sergeant Austin, a blonde sophomore from Connecticut with green eyes and a sneaky smile, will go off on one of us and then announce, "Don't take this personally. I hate you all just the same." I was given this dubious reassurance more than others. For those first few days, I woke up furious and went to bed even more livid. The target of my rage was my mother. How could she send me away? How could she force me into a military school before I was even a teenager? When she dropped me off the first day, I was in full ice grill mode, lip curled, eyes squinting, with my screw-the-world face on, ready for battle. But inside, I was bewildered. I felt betrayed. I felt more alone than ever. By the end of my fourth day at military school, I had run away four times. I heard that there was a station somewhere in Wayne where I could catch a train that would take me to 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. From there, I could transfer to a train that would take me to Penn Station in New York, which would take me to the number 2 subway train, which would drop me off on the grimy streets that would take me home. I had the entire plan set. The only thing I couldn't figure out was how to get to this train station in Wayne. One morning, my roommate and I were in our tight 5x8 room, sitting on our respective wooden chairs, shining our shoes. My roommate was from Brooklyn, and we were the only two New Yorkers in the entire unit. I partially blame him for my being in military school, because it was his grandmother who first told my mother about Valley Forge. My roommate's uncle had graduated from the school years earlier and was now a successful business executive. So when my mom, who was friendly with her family, was looking for a new environment for me, they enthusiastically recommended this school. Paralleling my mom's insistence that I attend Riverdale because John F. Kennedy had once gone to school there, she was won over to Valley Forge when she heard that General Norman Schwarzkopf was a graduate. This was right after the first Gulf War, and General Schwarzkopf was seen as the second coming of General MacArthur. There was no military history in my family, but for them, as for many immigrant families, American heroes and the schools they attended carried a certain cachet. I glanced at my roommate, burning with resentment. I just finished shining the tip of my left shoe and was scooping out a helping of polish for the right shoe when our door opened. "Tan Hunt!" my roommate yelled, jumping to his feet upon seeing our squad leader enter the room. I followed suit. Sergeant Austin looked directly at my roommate and told him to leave the room. My roommate quickly dropped the rest of his shining kit and scurried out, shutting the door behind him. I had no idea what I'd done this time, but it couldn't be good. I was afraid that something serious was about to happen, and Austin had cleared the room because he wanted no witnesses. I stood at attention, but braced myself for whatever was about to go down. To my surprise, Austin told me to sit down. I dropped to my chair, but stayed tense. Austin grabbed my roommate's chair, turning it around like we were old buddies about to have a heart-to-heart. He looked at me, almost with pity, and said, "Listen, Moore, you don't want to be here, and quite honestly, we don't want you here. So I've drawn you a map of how to get to the train station." He handed me a guide on, a manila-colored book the size of a small spiral notebook that contained all of the knowledge we had to memorize in order to make the transition from plebe to new cadet. The book included items such as a mission statement of the school, the honor code, the cadet resolution, and all of the military and cadet ranks. More important to me at the time, the back of the book had an aerial map of the Wayne area, and on this particular copy, handwritten notes with clear directions to the train station. I looked at the map and was momentarily struck dumb. There was nothing I wanted more than to join my friends, to see my family, to leave this place. To see my mother. Here was my squad leader, for whom I had no love, giving me what felt like one of the greatest gifts I had ever received. The burden of loneliness was suddenly lifted. Someone finally understood me. This map was my path to freedom. This map was my path home. When I looked up from the map and into the eyes of Sergeant Austin, happiness overwhelmed me. I smiled uncontrollably and thanked him. "I will never forget you," I proclaimed. He rolled his eyes and simply said, "Yeah, just get out of here." He stood up from the chair, and I got up and snapped to attention, showing the first real sign of respect I'd given him since walking through the gates. As he exited the room, shutting the door behind him, my mind was spinning. I began to plan my great escape. At 10 o'clock every night, Taps was played by a military bugler in the main parade area. Taps denoted the end of the day. The hauntingly slow anthem played loudly as the entire corps stopped and stood in the deferential parade rest position until the final note ended. Taps is also played at funerals, a way of paying homage to lost comrades. I bowed my head but couldn't suppress a smile. I knew this would be the last time I would have to endure this depressing song. I set my alarm for midnight, thinking that would be late enough for everyone to be asleep, but early enough to give me a significant head start before the pre-dawn nightmare of wake-up call repeated itself. I could begin my journey back home undisturbed. My alarm clock, which was no larger than the palm of my hand, sat under my pillow, so when the alarm went off, it would be loud enough for me, and only me, to hear. My night bag, which contained only a flashlight, a few changes of clothes, and a granola bar, sat under my bunk bed, packed and ready to go. It was the Shawshank Redemption, and I was about to become Andy Dufresne. 2 hours after Taps, I was up and tiptoeing through the hallways until I hit the blood-red door that took me into the night. With nothing but a bag over my shoulder, a map, and directions written on the back of the guidon in my left hand, and a tiny flashlight in my right hand, I was gone. I never looked back at Wheeler Hall, my residence building, as I quietly bolted through the door. "Goodbye and good riddance," I thought. I followed the map to a T, pacing my steps, trying to identify the landmarks that my squad leader had highlighted. The quarter moon was not providing much light, so I trained my pen-sized flashlight on the guidon. The map was leading me in directions I hadn't seen in my brief time at the school, through bushes and brush that quickly turned to trees and forests. But I stuck to the directions, and to hope, and imagined that in a short time, the trees would open up and reveal the train station sitting there waiting for me. Minutes later, that hope was rapidly diminishing. In its place was a different feeling. Terror. As I patrolled through the forest, my movie-saturated imagination began to run wild. I was having hallucinations. I started to hear snakes and bears and other wild animals. The affluent suburb of Wayne might as well have been the Serengeti the way I imagined the animals surrounding me. I was against the ropes in my battle with fear, and I lost my bearing, my pace count, my control. Finally, I sat down on a rock that I could have sworn I had just tripped over 10 paces back and began to cry. I was defeated. I had never wanted anything more in my life than to leave that school, and I was slowly coming to the realization that it was not going to happen. As I sat on the rock weeping, I heard the rustling of leaves and brush behind me. I had been imagining wild animals for a while now, but these sounds were more intense. My ears perked up, and my head snapped to attention. I turned in the direction of the sounds and suddenly heard a chorus of laughter. Out of the darkness came the members of my chain of command, including my new friend, Sergeant Austin. Bastard, I thought. The directions he'd given me were fake. They'd led me nowhere but to the middle of the woods. Without a fight, I got up from the rock and walked with them back to campus. With my head bowed, we entered the main building and went straight to my tactical officer's office. Colonel Battaglioli, or Colonel Bat as we called him, sat in his office as my chain of command led me in. I was broken, dead-eyed, with my night bag still on my shoulder and the utterly useless folded map in my pocket. Colonel Bat was a retired Army officer with 26 years in the service. He had served all over the world, including combat tours in Vietnam. He walked fast, his body at a 45-degree angle to the ground, as if he was leaning into every step. When he saluted, It seemed like the force of his entire body went into it. He spoke like an understudy for Al Pacino, all spit and curved vowels. He was new to the job at Valley Forge. We were his first plebe class, and I was his first major challenge. Plebe system is a process all new arrivals must go through in order to earn the title of new cadet. As a plebe, you refer to yourself in the third person. This plebe would like to go to the bathroom. This plebe requests permission to eat. In plebe system, your plebe brothers are all you have to make it through. And to ensure that, there is no communication with the outside world. No phone calls, no televisions, no radios, no visits. Colonel Bat looked at my eyes, which were downcast and barely open, and realized that if he didn't bend the rules just slightly, he would lose me for good. "Look at me, moi," he firmly commanded. I lifted my eyes. Colonel Bat continued, "I'm going to let you talk on the phone for 5 minutes, and that is it for the rest of plebe system. Call who you need to, but you'd better be snapped out of this when that phone hangs up." I looked around the room and saw four members of my chain of command looking down on me. I also noticed a man I had not seen before, but whose presence dominated the room, demanding not only focus, but respect. He was black, stood about 5'10", and carried a muscular 210 pounds or so. He peered down on me through his glasses with laser-like intensity. His uniform was pressed so sharp, you could have cut paper with the cuffs on his khaki shorts. He appeared to be still a teenager, but carried an old soul and a frighteningly serious demeanor. He didn't say a word, but he didn't have to. His look said it all. Colonel Bat handed me the phone, and I dialed the only number I knew by heart. As the phone rang, I began to think about what I would say in 5 minutes to convince my mother to let me back home. "Hello?" Her voice was groggy, reminding me that it was 1 o'clock in the morning. "Hey, Ma, it's me," I said a little too loud, excited to hear her voice after what had been the four longest days of my life. She got nervous at the sound of my voice. She wasn't supposed to hear from me for at least another month. She asked me if everything was all right, and I assured her I was fine. Then I started my 5-minute campaign to come home. "Ma, I know I haven't been perfect, but I promise to do better. I will pay attention in school and go more often. I will clean my room. I will clean your room. I will..." She cut me off. "Wes, you are not going anywhere until you give this place a try. I am so proud of you, and your father is proud of you, and we just want you to give this a shot. Too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be there." I had no idea then, but I later found out just what sacrifices she was talking about. When she first heard about Valley Forge, she told my grandparents about her plan. They were strongly in favor of the idea. The problem was that military school is not free. It's not even cheap. The price tag for Valley Forge was even steeper than that for Riverdale. My mother had written to family and friends, asking them to help her however they could. "I wouldn't ask if I didn't really need it," she wrote. Weeks later, she was still thousands of dollars short. My grandparents knew that I was at a crucial juncture in my life. These forks in the road can happen so fast for young boys. Within months or even weeks, their journeys can take a decisive and possibly irrevocable turn. With no intervention, or the wrong intervention, they can be lost forever. My mother made the decision to intervene, and decided that overdoing it was better than doing nothing at all. She felt my environment needed to change and my options needed to expand drastically. My grandparents agreed. They put most of their money into the home, hoping to use their equity to support themselves in retirement when they would return to Jamaica to be with family and friends. Now that my grandparents knew they were needed in the Bronx, their desire to move back to Jamaica had faded. Their children and grandchildren were here. Their friends and doctors were here. And more than that, they now considered themselves not Jamaicans who were living in America, but Americans of Jamaican descent. My grandparents took the money they had in the home in the Bronx, decades of savings and mortgage payments, and gave it to my mother so that she could pay for my first year of military school. As I sat on the other end of the line, listening to my mother talk about sacrifice, I had no idea what my grandparents had given up. The 5 minutes went fast, and Colonel Bat signaled it was time for me to hang up and go to bed. I love you, and I'm proud of you. And Wes, it's time to stop running, my mother said as I hung up. I was sent back to my room to lie down for the 3 hours before I would be driven awake again by the same trash can drumming, light flashing, music blaring, insult-laden wake-up call as every other godforsaken morning in this hellhole. The next day, as we prepared to head to second mess, which was what they tellingly called lunch, I noticed the black man from the night before standing next to Colonel Batt. They were talking and looking in my direction. Even when I was standing at attention with my eyes to the front, their piercing gazes felt like they were burning a hole through me. Finally, the two men saluted, and the black man walked back toward F Company, the college freshmen and sophomores. It was known around the entire Corps as the most squared away, the most impressive company. Its members were the best marchers, the most athletic, the most disciplined. Whoever was in charge of them was doing an amazing job. I wondered whether that man who was talking to Colonel Batt was going to fall into the ranks, but as my eyes followed him, I heard the thunderous sound of 120 men all snapping to attention. 19-year-old Cadet Captain Ty Hill took his place at the front of F Company. In spite of myself, I was impressed. I had never seen anything like that before. I had never seen a man, a peer, demand that much respect from his people. I'd seen Shay demand respect in the neighborhood, but this was different. This was real respect, the kind you can't beat or scare out of people. That's when I started to understand that I was in a different environment. Not simply because I was in the middle of Pennsylvania instead of the Bronx or Baltimore. It was a different psychological environment, where my normal expectations were inverted, where leadership was honored and class clowns were ostracized. I was still watching Captain Hill out of the corner of my eye when Colonel Batt moved towards me. After I'd left Colonel Batt's office the night before, my mother had called back and asked to speak to Captain Hill. She had met him once through Colonel Bowe, the admissions officer who convinced her to send me to Valley Forge. I placed Bowe right up there with my roommate as a person to blame for my current existence. Colonel Bowe had told my mother, when she was still on the fence about military school, that he wanted to introduce her to a college sophomore from Texas who was about to become an officer in the Army and was one of the true stars of the school. When she saw Captain Hill on the day she went to the campus to drop me off, she asked him to keep an eye out for me. That night on the phone, she reminded him. When Colonel Batt got to me, he came close to my face and whispered in my ear with his fast-talking, raspy voice, "Moa, after you're done with Chow, go over to F Company and ask to see the company commander. He wants to talk to you." Wes and his godbrother, Red, moved towards the cheese bus as it slowly rolled to a stop in Dundee Village. The cheese bus, yellow and boxy like a block of government-issued cheese, picked kids up from Dundee Village and delivered them, 25 minutes later, to Perry Hall High School in West Baltimore. It had taken a while, but Wes was finally getting accustomed to the long route, the new school, and the new environment. He missed the city life, its speed, its intensity, its hustle. But Wes also came to understand that the county life was not exceptionally different from what he had known before. Life in the county was deceptively green and quiet, but he soon discovered that the hood came in different shapes and sizes. Wes and Red boarded the bus, giving the daily head nod to the driver, and walking down the aisle looking for a seat. Simultaneously, they spotted two girls they had never seen before. They slowed to take a second look. "You see them?" Wes whispered to Red, lifting his chin at the two teenagers. "Yeah, man. I want to holler at the skinny one," Red said. The line of students was beginning to pile up behind them, so they pushed ahead, finally throwing themselves into two open seats a few rows behind the girls they were admiring. Then they started strategizing. Wes's athletic physique and laid-back style, combined with the obvious trappings of a kid with disposable income, a new pair of sneakers every day, brand-name clothes, made him very popular with the girls around town. He had a dozen girlfriends, but nothing serious. He was just enjoying his teenage years and, at the moment, he was enjoying the view in front of him. Both girls lived inside Dundee Village with Wes, but this was the first time he had ever noticed them. They looked about the same age. One was a few inches taller than the other, and noticeably thinner, while the thick one had a frame that looked more mature. The weather was warm, so their clothes were short and tight, leaving little to the imagination. Wes and Red debated. Should they wait until they got to school or make a move during the ride? It was a short debate. You ready, man? I'ma go holler. Red said, remember, I got the thin one. After seeing Red jump from his seat, Wes followed, his book bag lightly slung over one shoulder. He put on his shy grin as they wheeled around to face the girls. What's y'all names? Red abruptly asked, interrupting the girls' conversation. The two girls gave each other the how rude face. Finally, they looked up at Wes and Red and answered. They were twins, as it turned out, even though they didn't look anything alike. Wes was amazed. I thought twins was supposed to be the same, he marveled. Wes and his new friend continued to talk all the way to school. She was a few years older than he was and found his shy half-smile cute. He liked her sense of humor and the way her skirt tugged against her teenage curves. Her dark eyes shone as she let her hand lightly brush against his forearms. As the cheese bus entered the school grounds, Wes asked if he could get her phone number. She pulled a pen out of her book bag and began to write her number down. As she was writing, Wes spied Red standing alone, looking agitated. Obviously, the thin one wasn't working out. As Wes's new friend left, he excitedly walked over to Red, unable to hide his grin. What happened, man? Wes asked. She has a boyfriend. I knew I should have tried to holler at that thick one. Wes and Alicia quickly became more than friends. After school, they would head to each other's houses, since neither had parents at home during the day. Within 2 months of their meeting, Alicia told Wes that her period was late. 4 tests and 8 matching plus signs later, it was confirmed. They were going to be parents. Wes was dazed. He kept the news to himself for an entire month. How could Alicia have let herself get pregnant? He thought maybe it was a mistake. Maybe the result would change. Maybe she was just reading the test wrong. Time went on, and Alicia started having morning sickness. Her period was still AWOL, and her belly began to rise. It was undeniable. Wes finally decided it was time to tell his people what was going on. The first person he thought to share the news with was Tony, who had just become a father himself. Wes caught up with Tony when he stopped by the house. Tony, I gotta talk to you. What's up? Tony replied. I'm gonna tell you something, but you need to promise you won't say anything to anybody, especially Mom. Tony was smirking, but when he caught the weight of his brother's voice, his face became serious. What's going on, man? You know I won't tell her. Alicia's pregnant. Like 3 months. Tony stared at his brother, paused for about 10 seconds, and then cracked up laughing. Their mother had had a baby a year ago, making it 3 boys in the Moore clan, and Tony thought that Wes having a brother and a son and a nephew, all around the same age, was hysterical. This is some sitcom shit, man, Tony declared, laughing. It was crazy. Wes smiled, but just a little. Whatever, man, just don't tell Mom yet. The idea of becoming a father depressed Wes, but he wasn't sure why. He didn't have to worry about feeling alone or like a pariah. Wes and Alicia's situation was anything but exceptional. In Baltimore in 1991, 11.7% of girls between the ages of 15 and 19 had given birth. More than 1 out of 10. He also didn't feel burdened by the thought that early parenthood would wreck his future plans, because he really didn't have any future plans. And he wasn't overly stressed about the responsibilities of fatherhood. He didn't even know what that meant. But in some unspoken way, he did sense that he was crossing a point of no return, that things were about to get complicated in a way he was unequipped to handle. A week later, Wes and Tony took their girlfriends to their mother's house to celebrate the first birthday of their baby brother. An ice cream cake with Happy First written in icing sat in the middle of the dining room table. Wes and Alicia sat on one side of the table, Tony and his girlfriend on the other. Mary, with her newest son in her lap, sat at the head of the table. When Mary stood to cut the cake, Tony was struck by the absurdity of the scene. Ma, isn't it crazy that you just had a baby, and we just had a baby, and there's someone else at the table pregnant? Tony cut himself off and assumed a surprised expression, as if he couldn't believe he just let the news slip out. Wes's eyes shot over to Tony. Alicia's eyes shot over to Wes. Mary's eyes shot over to Alicia. Wes whined that Tony was ruining what was supposed to be a nice family gathering. Mary didn't bother with their squabbling. Her attention was on Alicia. "Alicia, are you pregnant?" she asked, still standing with the cake knife poised in the air. Alicia's eyes did not leave Wes as she slowly nodded her head. Mary closed her eyes and took a deep breath. She put down the cake knife and locked her fingers behind her head, then arched her back as if trying to work out some deep tension. After a moment, she brought her arms back to her sides, exhaled, and looked around the table. "So, who wants cake?" The news of his imminent parenthood did not stop Wes from making time for other girls. Not surprisingly, this bothered Alicia, but she knew there wasn't much she could do about it. She hoped that she and Wes and the new baby would become a family. She hoped she could give her child the two-parent household that she never had. But before the baby even came into the world, she realized how unlikely that would be. Wes's non-existent relationship with his father probably contributed to his seeming indifference about becoming a father himself. All he knew was his mom. He had no idea what his role would be in this new situation. He wasn't even sure he had a role. The third and last time Wes met his father had been just a few months back. Wes and Tony were heading over to Shake and Bake, a popular West Baltimore roller skating rink. The rink was very close to the home of Wes's aunt, his father's sister, so they decided to stop by to say hello. Wes would often visit his paternal aunts, cousins, and grandparents when he went to Shake and Bake. They all lived in two houses on the same block. But when Wes and Tony entered his aunt's house, Wes's father was the first person they saw. He slept alone on the couch in the living room, oblivious to the blaring basketball game on the television, or the fact that his son had just walked in the house. Tony looked at Wes and said, "You see your pops over there?" Wes nodded, but then stood there silent, as if grasping for an emotion that was just out of reach. He had not seen his father in years and didn't know what he would say to him, or if he cared to say anything at all. At first, Wes considered leaving the house, just heading to the roller skating rink, but eventually he thought better of it. This was his father. He should at least say hello. Wes slowly walked up to the couch. His father was motionless. Wes put his hand under his father's nose, testing to see if he was even alive. After feeling the air coming in and out of his father's nostrils, Wes started poking his father in the side with his middle finger. The first few nudges didn't wake him, so finally, he just pushed at his father's shoulder. He pushed so hard the man's entire body rolled a little, but he stayed asleep. Finally, after some more jostling, his father's eyes cracked open. He saw Wes standing over him. Still squinting, he looked his son in the eyes. "Who are you?" Tony began to laugh hysterically. "I would punch that dude right in the face if I was you," he said to his brother in between laughs. Wes again found himself adrift emotionally, unsure where to anchor. Part of him was hurt, part ashamed, part relieved that the awkward conversation he had been dreading wouldn't be happening. Wes looked down at the man on the couch and clenched his fist, almost as if he was going to follow Tony's advice. But then his fingers eased, and he simply let off a smirk. Without knowing it, he was mirroring the smirk his mother had left his father with when she saw him on the couch years earlier. Wes nodded at Tony, and they left the house without another word. He never answered his father's question. Soon after hearing the news about Alicia's pregnancy, Wes met another girl. She told him she didn't live in Dundee, but her cousin did, on the other side of the complex. It wasn't long before Wes got a chance to see the inside of her cousin's house and the waterbed in her cousin's bedroom. Wes's visits became a regular thing. She returned the favor and visited Wes at his house. During one of those visits, Wes's new girl woke up in a panic, realizing how late it was. "Wes, I've got to get home. It is 1 o'clock. She sprang from the bed and began to put her clothes back on while Wes slowly sat up and wiped his eyes. He stretched and grumbled out a groggy command. "Make sure you be quiet when you leave so you don't wake up my mother." Wes's mother slept in the room next to Wes's and was unaware that her son had company. "Get up and walk me out. Be a gentleman," she replied. Wes was amused. This chick was a jump off, a sexual time filler. and he felt she had forfeited her right to be treated like a lady a long time ago. He laughed to himself, but got up and put on a pair of basketball shorts and a t-shirt so he could walk her to the door. The two tiptoed down the stairs, careful not to make any noise. When they reached the bottom of the stairs, they hugged, and Wes told the girl he would call her sometime soon. She stepped through the doorway, and before she could close it behind her, Wes heard another voice coming from outside.
What are you doing coming out of that nigga's house?
A tall, muscular, older teenager had stood up from the curb when he saw Wes's door open. It was not clear how long he'd been waiting there, but it was clear that he was not happy.
Why the hell are you out here spawning me, Ray?
She yelled back, quickly regaining her composure as she walked down Wes's stairs. The man quickly moved towards her, and they started shouting louder and louder, even as the distance between them closed. Wes stood at alert on his porch and watched for a few moments. Once he realized the man's anger was directed at the girl and not him, he decided to stay out of it. He wished they would quiet down, but other than that, he figured it wasn't any of his business. He turned his back on the two and moved toward the door so he could get upstairs and resume his night's sleep. As Wes stepped into his doorway, the man finally noticed him. He stopped yelling at his girl and launched himself toward Wes. He reached him in an instant, grabbed the back of his shirt collar, lifted him off the porch floor, and slammed him onto his back. Wes found himself splayed on the stairs, looking up at the night sky, the back of his head throbbing, unsure of what had just happened. Ray wasn't done. He began to take unmerciful swings at Wes's face. His left and right fists took turns hitting their target, while Wes tried to block the blows. The girl pulled at the man, trying to give Wes a little room to escape. Finally, Wes came to his feet and ran inside, but not before the man had significantly bloodied him up. Wes went inside, but he had no intention of staying there. He ran to his room and straight to his closet. He reached up to the top shelf and pulled out the shoebox that held his 9mm Beretta and a few full clips. Wes opened the box, grabbed the gun and clips, and threw the empty box on the floor. As he left his room, he shoved the clip into the gun and cocked the slide hammer back, fully loading the weapon. He ran down the stairs and out the door, only to see the girl standing there by herself. Her eyes immediately trained themselves on the gun in Wes's hand. Wes could only see red. He was blind with rage. Instincts kicked in. Tony's words rang through his mind. Send a message.
What are you going to do with that?
The girl demanded and tried to block Wes's path.
Shut up and get out of my way, Wes commanded.
He pushed her to the side and started scanning the block for a sign of the dude who just worked out on his face. Wes noticed one of his boys leaning out of a window along with dozens of other people who were now curiously watching. The boy was one of Wes's partners in his drug operation, and when he saw Wes standing in the night air, face bloodied, with a gun in hand, he had his cue to join the fight. As Wes continued to scan the block for any clue of where Ray ran to, his friend joined him with his own trusty burner ready to blast. The girl was still screaming at Wes, begging him to leave Ray alone. But for Wes, her voice faded into the background noise of a now alert Dundee village. After slowly pacing his street, looking for any movement, he finally saw what he was looking for. Ray leaped up from behind a car farther down the block and began sprinting, ducking behind cars as he moved around the enclosed complex. Wes chased after him. As they ran, he and his friend pointed their weapons in Ray's direction and began taking shots. Wes quickly figured out where Ray was heading and realized that this must be the cousin his jump-off was always visiting. Wes and his friend cut into an alley, trying to intercept Ray before he could get to his house. Every time Ray rose from a hiding position, Wes and his friend would take turns firing shots at him, not only to try to hit him, but to keep him from getting to his house. Shots rang through the development, and car windows were shot out, while the people staring out their windows backed away, trying to avoid stray gunfire. Wes and his friend ran through a dark alley, jumping over trash cans and fences, trying to get to the other side of the complex as fast as possible. Multiple shots had been fired, but the foot race to the house continued. All three of their hearts pounded. None of them would have imagined hours earlier what kind of night this would turn out to be. As Ray's house came into view for all three young men, Ray decided to make a run for it, ducking behind a row of parked cars. Wes and his friend traded shots and finally heard Ray scream as he fell behind a black Toyota just 50 feet from his house. Wes and his friend stopped running. They saw no movement and figured the job was done. Not only that, but the entire neighborhood seemed to be awake now, so they ran back to their homes, hoping to avoid identification. Adrenaline was rushing through Wes's body, followed quickly by fear, but no regret. Ray was a fool for stepping to him like that. He'd started something that Wes had no choice but to finish. The girl Wes had been with was crying and screaming when he arrived back at his house. She was saying she was going to tell the police on him. Wes ran right by her, ignoring her threats as he slammed his front door behind him. He was met by his mother, who was now awake and irate. "What is going on, Wes? What did you do?" she demanded. Wes ran by her, and without even looking back, told her nothing was wrong and to go to bed. The blood on Wes's face and clothes, and the weapon in his hand, told a very different story. Wes went straight to the bathroom. He shut and locked the door and began filling the sink with warm water. The pool of water quickly turned red as the blood fell from his face into the sink. He picked up his washcloth and a bar of soap and began to clean the blood coming from his nose and mouth. His mother was outside the door, knocking ferociously, demanding to know what had happened. Wes continued to clean his face as if she wasn't there. Finally, vexed and frustrated, Mary called the only person she knew could find out what had happened. "Tony, Wes was involved in something out here, and I can't figure out what's going on. He's all bloody." Tony jumped in his car and started driving toward Baltimore County. Wes finished cleaning his face and removed his bloody shirt. After throwing his ruined clothes into the bathroom garbage can, he went to his bedroom and closed the door behind him. He still had the gun in his hand and knew he wouldn't be alone for long. In the corner of the room was a large fish tank that was only a quarter full, but the bottom was covered with rocks and dark mud that clouded the water. Living in the tank were not fish, but a large green snapping turtle that took up almost half of the 65-gallon tank. The gun was still hot, so it created a small sizzle as it hit the cool water of the tank. Wes moved the sand around, clouding the already murky water even more, hoping it would hide the gun. Wes heard commotion downstairs, and he knew his time was just about up. He reached into the wooden drawer next to his bed and got a clean blue shirt with white stripes on it. He pulled the shirt over his head and pushed his arms through the sleeves as he heard a parade of feet charging up the stairs. Wes hurriedly smoothed the shirt down and put his hands in the air, not wanting the cops to think he was armed. He knew how that scenario would end. Seconds later, Wes was being pushed face down onto his own bed, his hands locked in cuffs behind his back. He was escorted downstairs by three police officers, led to the back of their car, and shoved in. Wes could see police officers talking to witnesses about what they'd seen. He eyed the crowd. The jump-off he blamed for starting this mess was nowhere to be found. Wes's mother walked up to the back seat of the police car where her son sat and began to yell at him in between her tears. Through the car window and over the commotion in the streets, Wes tried to tell his mother to calm down. While the cops were still speaking to witnesses, he told her where the gun was. She asked him if he was the one who shot the boy, but Wes didn't answer. He simply stared at his mother with a blank expression, his head still spinning from the last hour's events. She asked him again, softly pleading with him to tell her something. Just then, the cop showed up and ordered her away from the car. Two officers entered the cruiser and prepared to head back to the station. They had all the information they needed. They started the engine, and the blue and red lights on top of their cars began to flash. As the cruiser began to pull off, Wes asked him to stop for a moment so he could say something to his mother. The driver slowed to a stop and rolled down the window next to Wes's head just a crack. "Ma!" Wes yelled. She was on her way into the house when she heard his voice. She ran to him. When she got closer, Wes craned his head to speak through the crack in the window. "About your question." "I don't know the answer." The car pulled off. Wes closed his eyes and leaned his head against the black plastic seat. The street began to clear, and after watching the car fade into the distance, Mary headed back inside her house. Minutes later, Tony arrived. His mother stared at him, her face drained of emotion. "It's too late," she told him. "Wes is already gone." Chapter 6. Hunted. 1994. The steady flow of people entering the Northern High School gymnasium had slowed to a trickle as the 3 o'clock start time for graduation arrived. The wooden bleachers that circled the floor were full of family, friends, and supporters of the crop of graduates who had yet to enter the room. Within an hour, they would watch the high school experience of their children, grandchildren, siblings, nieces, and nephews come to an end. Many in the audience had thought the day would never come, but all were happy it did. The state of Maryland had one of the highest graduation rates in the nation. 76% of high school students who began high school in Maryland completed. In Baltimore County, the number was as high as 85% in some years. But in Baltimore City, where Northern High School was located, it was a dismal 38%. For many in the audience, this was the first high school graduation they had ever attended. The procession of black robes entering the room was replaced by a wave of forest green robes. The students trailed shortly after the faculty. Smiles, waves, cheers, and whistles rang out. Camera flashes blinked over the parade, parents and friends shooting as wildly as paparazzi. Because his last name put him towards the front of the class, Woody was one of the first to enter the gym, walking with a confident strut. He saw his parents, sister, and grandmother, and smiled. He grabbed the edge of his green cap between his thumb and index finger and tipped it to them, a sign of respect and gratitude. Woody was one of the students who made it across the finish line kicking and screaming. He'd needed 2 points in the last few weeks to pass English. Gym was his favorite class. Every other class tied for last place. But as he entered the area where all the students were sitting to prepare for the ceremony, he knew none of that mattered. All that mattered was that he was here. He had accomplished his mission of completing high school. The principal, valedictorian, guest speaker, and the rest of the graduation speakers gave their speeches as Woody fought to stay awake. Finally, the moment he was waiting for arrived. The principal asked the class to rise, and one by one they walked across the stage to receive their diplomas. If the entire class that had started the ninth grade here had finished, it would have been a very long ceremony. But only 87 seats were filled that spring morning. This wouldn't take nearly as long as it should have. When it was Woody's turn, he practically danced up to the principal. The crowd laughed as Woody shook the principal's hand and looked up at his family, throwing his arms in the air in a triumphant stance. He carefully jogged down the steps at the end of the stage. As he turned the corner and looked at the dozens of folding chairs where the graduates were sitting, his mind wandered to the people who weren't there. He thought about Damon, a ninth grade classmate who didn't make it to the end of the year. Day took a month off from school to care for his mother, who was sick with sickle cell. That month turned to two, and finally, Day stopped being a student. Woody thought about White Boy, his boy from the neighborhood, who picked up a job working at a restaurant called Poor Folks. He was tired of school and decided joining the workforce was a better option. Most of all, Woody thought about Wes, who had stopped going to school 2 years earlier. Wes returned to Dundee Village 6 months after being locked up for the incident in which he shot at Ray. Wes caught two bricks that night. The first was that the bullet entered Ray's shoulder and went straight through. No major organs were hit, and Ray left the hospital a day later. So Wes was charged with attempted murder rather than murder. The second break was that Wes's case was sent to juvenile court instead of adult court. His attorney argued he should be tried as a juvenile because he would not be a potential threat to the community. Wes went back to school immediately after leaving the juvenile detention facility, the Baltimore County Detention Center in Towson. He enrolled at Lake Clifton High School in East Baltimore, but knew pretty quickly that he would not last long. He was 2 years older than the other kids in his grade from repeating a grade and losing time locked up. Teachers already dealing with overcrowded classrooms didn't have time to teach Wes the basics he had missed. Wes's attendance became sporadic, and once his first child was born, he just stopped going. Not surprisingly, without a high school diploma or job training, and with a criminal record, Wes found it almost impossible to find a job to support his growing family. Alicia was living with the baby in her mother's house while Wes stayed with his aunt Niecy. Niecy was strict and made it clear from the day Wes moved in who was in charge. You need to either get a job or go to school. One of the two, but neither is not an option. Wes found another option. He decided to make himself scarce. In the mornings while Niecy was at work, Wes would play video games in the house and then head out to check on his drug operation. When she was home in the evenings or in the early morning, Wes would normally be out, trying to find a job, as he would tell her. This charade went on for months. Wes didn't live there so much, as he used Niecy's home as a place to rest, and increasingly, a place to hide his drugs. Wes had his entire drug operation organized with the precision of a military unit or a division of a Fortune 500 company. The drug game had its own rules, its own structure. He was a lieutenant, the leader of his small crew. Everyone in the crew had a specific job with carefully delineated responsibilities. On the lowest rung of the ladder, and in most cases the youngest kids on the team, were the corner boys. These were the kids, sometimes as young as 7, but normally no older than 11, who served as the lookouts for cops. They would huddle on corners, and when they saw a cop, or anyone who looked like a cop, they would yell, "Hey Tina," or "Hey Susan," or whatever name the crew had designated for the week. That way they could alert the crew that cops were creeping, but if the cops questioned them, they could simply say they were calling out for a friend and walk away unscathed. The hitters were the ones who dealt with the money. This job was very important, for obvious reasons, and you needed to trust your hitter. This was also one of the most dangerous jobs, because if the money ever came up short, the hitter was the one whose neck was on the line. The housemen were in charge of distribution. The drugs were usually cooked and cut in a house, and the housemen would have to make sure the sellers had their supply for the day. The housemen also resupplied the ground soldiers if they sold their allocated amount. Last, you had the muscle, who were there to protect the crew and the lieutenant. They were usually carrying weapons of various kinds and were not afraid to use them. A crew's relevancy, their ability to hold their own corner and expand the business, was dependent on the amount of muscle they controlled and the level of violence their muscle was ready to get into. Sometimes, entire crews were muscle. This was the crew. They would work together, fight together, stay together. An unbreakable bond united the crew. For many members, it was the only support system they had. It was family. Wes managed his team extremely well. At their peak, his team brought in over $4,000 a day. He wasn't one of the main players by any stretch, but he was not doing badly in relation to others in the neighborhood. There were over 100,000 known addicts in Baltimore, and the real number was arguably higher. Given that the city had a population of just under 700,000, there was an obvious glut of addicts. With a demand like that, and an ample supply, it was hard not to make money. Still, Wes would find himself wondering about the percentage of that money that found its way into his pocket. He and his team were taking all the risks. They were the ones who faced the arrests and the danger. His bosses, the connects, and the ones bringing the drugs into Baltimore were making the real money. They never had to show their faces on the hard corners where the supply looked the demand in the eye. It started to become clear to Wes. The drug game was raw capitalism on overdrive with bullets, a pyramid scheme whose base was dead bodies and ruined lives. Wes stood in the corner of Dundee Village. He no longer lived there, but he had a little operation there. He would bring drugs into the county because he could sell them for a higher premium than in the city. He was surrounded by some guys from his crew. His day was ending. It was 3 p.m. and he planned to pick up a girl from around the way to go to the movies. He had to get moving, but he lingered. He liked the feeling of holding down a corner with his boys. It was the one place he felt safe, or at least in his element. Wes's green jumpsuit hung over a glossy green t-shirt. His Gianni Brunelli shoes matched his outfit. Wes stayed fresh. He was saying his final goodbyes when a man sidled up to him. He was clean-shaven, wearing jeans and an oversized t-shirt. Wes had never seen this cat before. "Do you guys know where I can buy some rocks?" the man asked, his voice conspiratorially gruff. There are a few major tip-offs that tell dealers something isn't right. If a person looks unfamiliar or really out of place, it's probably a cop. If a person you saw arrested a few minutes ago is suddenly back on the street trying to buy from you, he's probably doing it for a cop. If a person is usually a dime bag customer and is now trying to buy a brick, he's probably working for the cops. If someone's lingo is wrong, if he comes up to you saying, "Do you guys know where I can buy some rocks?" there's a good chance he's a cop. "Nope," Wes replied, eyeing the man up and down. The man began to walk away with his head swiveling, seemingly searching for someone else to get drugs from. Wes moved in the opposite direction, toward the girl's house. But for some reason, he couldn't let that sail go. He paused, taking a second look at the man. Wes thought about the small change he was turning down. The man threw up red flags, but Wes had dealt to people like that before and gotten away with it. He saw the man approach another corner boy and then walk away. Wes got antsy. The movie was starting soon, and if he was going to change his mind and make the sale, he better do it fast. He couldn't stop thinking about the money he could make off the sale, almost exactly enough to take care of this date. The logic felt right. Wes looked to his right, saw a public phone booth, and he began to move in that direction. As he approached the booth, he reached into his pocket and pulled out 2 dime bags of crack cocaine, $20 worth. He placed the small, clear, Ziploc bags in the phone's metal-covered coin return bucket. He quickly scanned his surroundings, checking to see if anyone had seen his drop. When he felt sure that he'd been undetected, he moved toward the potential buyer. It was a risk, and Wes knew it. But taking risks is at the heart of the drug enterprise. And scared money didn't make money. "Hey, come here real quick," Wes yelled to the man, still wandering aimlessly around the block. The man's head snapped up quickly. Wes looked him up and down again, desperate to recognize him and put his mind at ease. He couldn't. The man moved closer. Wes grabbed his right shoulder and pulled him in close. "I don't know who it was that told me, but if you give me $20, you can go over there to that phone booth and they said you'd be taken care of." The man nodded as his eyes met Wes's. As Wes took the money, their hands touched briefly. The man's hands were smooth and his nails were clean. Damn. It was time to get moving. Wes started walking, never looking back. He placed a $20 bill in his pants pocket and picked up the pace to the girl's house. He popped a breath mint in his mouth. As he turned the corner, he heard a yell behind him. "Stop moving and get your hands up!" Wes kept walking. He looked forward, hoping they weren't speaking to him, hoping they'd just disappear. He maintained the same pace until he caught sight of 2 men running toward him. Guns in hand and silver badges swinging from metal chains around their necks, the men pointed their weapons at Wes and ordered him to the ground. Wes saw another man, wearing a woodland camouflage shirt, crawling from beneath the bushes, reaching in his waist, and pulling out a weapon. In total, 10 police officers moved toward Wes. He got down on his knees and laced his fingers behind his head. "What did I do, man? I didn't do anything wrong," Wes pleaded with the cop, who was reaching over to cuff him while the rest kept their weapons on him. Getting arrested was starting to feel routine. Wes wasn't shocked or afraid anymore, just annoyed. Why him? Why now? Why couldn't they just leave him alone? He had enough to worry about. Wes continued to plead his case as the police read him his rights. Ding, ding! 2 bells ran through the mess hall, signaling the Corps of Cadets to leave lunch and head back to barracks for their afternoon classes. At the sound of the bells, the Corps moved en masse toward the cafeteria doors at the end of the building. I stood up from my chair and ordered my platoon to stand fast, or remain still, as I reminded them about the room inspection that was going to take place immediately after school. My platoon responded with a coordinated, "Yes, Sergeant," and began to join the flood headed towards the door. I was now a platoon sergeant, a cadet master sergeant, and the youngest senior non-commissioned officer in the entire Corps. 3 years ago, I had been one of the insubordinate kids first entering the gates of Valley Forge. In an ironic turn, I was now one of the ones in charge of them. My mother had noticed the way I had changed since leaving for military school. My back stood straight, and my sentences now ended with sir or ma'am. My military garrison cap was intentionally a size too big, forcing me to keep my head up, walking taller with every step. Our standard motto, no excuses, no exceptions, and our honor code, a cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those that do, were not simply words we had to memorize, but words to live by. With the support of people like Cadet Captain Hill and the others in my chain of command and on the faculty, I had actually started to enjoy military school. They made it clear that they cared if I succeeded, and eventually, so did I. The financial strain Valley Forge brought on my mother was lessened significantly after the first year, when the school gave me academic, and later, athletic scholarships. On my way back to the barracks, I met up with my friend and plebe brother, Sean, Sean, from a single-parent household in central New Jersey, had lost his father when he was young as well. We'd started Valley Forge at the same time and lived down the hall from each other. We were among the few still at the school from our